All right, man. Thanks for coming on. I feel like you should have been like one of the first five people I talked to. And I don't even know why I'm such a clown and just invited you on now. The funniest thing about why you're here is really because we shouldn't even know each other.
I happen to be an Indian guy. That's
correct.
That you happen to have been meeting an Indian guy the day that we met.
It's the most horrible thing.
Yeah. So sometimes it's good to be brown.
Facts. Because I'm staying at this hotel in New York. I'm here to meet a friend who's a VC, and I know nothing about him other than his name.
I was like, it's
an Indian name.
Yeah.
I walked down into the lobby.
His name was Raj, right?
Neil.
That's
yeah. Okay. Shout out to Neil. What's up, bro?
There you go.
He's definitely going to be watching this because we're buddies now too.
There you go.
I walk out into the lobby and I see a very handsome Indian man in a nice blue sport coat and nice glasses. And I just said, Neil. And you're just looking at me. You're like, I'm sorry. Are you talking to me? I'm like, Neil, it's Nick. You're like, I'm not Neil.
That's it. Yeah.
I think you're looking for another Indian guy. I was like, and shoot me. Just shoot me right now in public.
No, I think it was the early days of the Ned in Nomad. And
yeah.
I was, you know, I feel like being social is better than being antisocial.
Sure.
So that's an obvious
thing. Even for clowns that walk down into the lobby and think you're somebody else.
No, but look, it was clear that, you know, I think you gave off an energy that, frankly, I believe in the principle of sympathetic resonance. You know, you kind of see people with good energy and you try to hang out with them.
Uh-huh.
And you know, but I think, obviously, since then, we've become friends. And
yeah.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, if anyone who's listening to this is familiar with the skits, we've got two characters, right? One character just tries to smash through the wall. And the other character just goes, oh, there's a door over there. So when I walked down and humiliated myself, you didn't say, you know, man, you're a real fucking clown. You know what I mean? You said, well, hang on. Who's Neil? Maybe I know him. So I'm like,
because all Indian people know each other.
Correct. That's, correct. You know, I didn't know that at
only,
the time.
Only a billion plus people, but we all
but
know
but there's
each other.
Some, yeah, yeah, 6 degrees, if even smaller. And so you go, hey, I might know him. What's the VC? And I'm like, oh, well, this and that. You're like, oh, I do know him.
I knew people he worked with.
Yeah. You do know that, familiar with the VC. And then I'm like, I like this. This is a lot more fun. And then we started talking and having a laugh and talking about what we do. And he was talking about little AI, little this, little that, little social media. And then Neil, actual Neil, walks in and he's like, who the hell are you? What are you guys doing? He felt like completely left out. He's like, am I interrupting? I'm like, hey, this is who I thought you were. And this guy's fucking awesome. And so
we chatted after that. Neil and I connected after that, by the way.
So guys,
once, but
everyone from this exchange is friends or acquaintances now.
That's right.
Now, isn't that a beautiful thing?
It is. It's the beauty of New York.
It's the beauty of a certain style of facing reality. Don't give New York credit because I know plenty of people who'd look at me and be like, you know what, dude, you're an asshole. I'm not Neil. Why'd you think I was Neil? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Instead, there's this magical way that you can go through life and just see opportunity and see connection.
Right.
And I feel like you embodied that, and you've probably have been doing that for quite some time. And that's a bit of a cheat code.
Not a long time. I was, super introverted and shy through most of my childhood. And unfortunately, I think I may have, gifted that to my daughter as well, but she's been amazing. But I think that, it's an active process to pull yourself out of that. And then after some time, it becomes more, it just becomes instinctual. So, now, you know, look, I enjoy meeting people. I think that the world has become incredibly, people are losing the ability to talk to each other because now everything is, people are connecting on apps and this and that. And it's taken out the part of the equation where you don't know the other person. And so you kind of are forced to become a more charming and wittier version of yourself and listen and pay attention and try to create a real rapport and connection. And I think honestly, that's the joy of human existence is getting to know people, really getting to know people.
Right. Not, hey, we had a Zoom call.
Yeah, exactly.
We're friends.
Exactly.
Bullshit.
Exactly.
Well, you should see the shock in people's face when I say, oh, no, we don't record this virtually. They're like, yeah, but I'm in California. I'm like, okay, well, then I'll fly to California. Like,
oh, wow. Yeah.
I'm not doing this virtually.
Right.
Okay, because at the end of every episode, whether it's an hour or 3 hours, I've had a conversation with you unbroken.
Right.
I mean, dude, I don't even talk to my own friends that long in an unbroken fashion.
Right.
So what you've done is, number one, you've vibrated at the same level frequency about some topic.
Right.
You've hit this rhythm. You're in a flow state.
Right.
No one's allowed to look at their phones. I mean, you're allowed to. I don't know where mine is. But the bottom line is, it's like, what could be more intimate and interesting than that?
Right.
And like, sure, some people come on here and they want to talk about their products and they want to do this and that and do a promotion, all this kind of, great. And I get paid for it. But the reason I'm doing this is because every marathon filming session, I walk away with 10 new friends.
Right.
You know, in a very real sense. So like last night, I get invited to this absolutely freaking cool party and I can't go into more details, but it was just like, oh, not only did I meet a great guest and have an awesome conversation and everyone's going to love it when the pod comes out, I'm now meeting more and more people through this node.
Right.
And then if you're someone who's present and wants to embrace the cool, awesome stuff that starts to cascade, you're like, well, this just keeps getting better and better.
Right.
And then you're in the room with these people that you perhaps wouldn't have been in the room before. Certainly you couldn't have been in the room if you were on a Zoom call.
Oh, no, absolutely. And yeah, because you're not in the same state, let alone zip code. It's just there's something about human interaction that I think generates a much more genuine engagement and interest.
Yeah.
And I think that's, we need to get back to that. And we really do. I mean, if nothing else, the pandemic, I think, proved to us that all of us crave in-person human contact. We didn't realize that until after we were deprived of that for so long.
Yeah.
And after that, everyone's like, all right, let's just go travel and meet people. And, you know, the idea of just doing business on Zoom is, you know, it's not personal. It doesn't engage people. It doesn't make people feel invested.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a problem. And I think what you're doing here is in part the solution, right? Like start to engage, start to have real conversations and start to really, like you said, find that vibration and kind of come in sync with it.
Yeah. I mean, I would push this a step further. Mm-hmm. You know, business doesn't move. There's a velocity of deals when you're doing them from Zoom. Because you could say, I could talk to 30 founders in, you know, 2 days.
Right.
Where you couldn't do that before, perhaps. Unless you had a fucking American Idol style, you know, audition room set up, right? And now, the room I walked into last night, I felt like I stepped into a time portal into like the good old days. Like everyone knew each other. Everyone was doing monstrous things. Mm-hmm. It was just like this powerhouse room. And everyone was like, social to a degree that you would consider like this person is really good at sitting around and talking to people.
Right.
No one there was like at the table, just like, I don't know how I got here.
Right.
I don't know why I'm here.
Right.
You know, I don't really want to be here. Everyone was like dialed in, even if they were maybe de facto introverted, they were there to, hey, I feel like I could learn.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
Or feel like I can make a lot of money here. I feel I could sell my company here.
But I think, you know, part of it is it's also patience and understanding that you keep investing into these relationships over time. You know, give you a few examples. I mean, that's how business is done everywhere else. It's only, I think, really it's unique to the U.S. experience to kind of do a lot of business without actually interacting in person.
Interesting.
you know, I spent a lot of time. I lived in Hong Kong, I lived in India, I lived in Singapore for work. And, you know, a lot of my investors and capital I've raised has come from those places. And it took 3, 4, 5, 6 years of going and meeting them, you know, 6, 7 times a year to get them comfortable enough to even present me to their investment committee. After that, they invest and it's super sticky. And, you know, in the US side, like, just if you kind of pivot and use that same idea, like one of the investors in my startup turned me down for my first startup in 1999.
Wow.
And we stayed in contact. We stayed close. We kept talking. And, you know, 1999 till today, you fast forward, and in, you know, 2023, they finally invested with me. It's 24 years of investing in a relationship. But, you know, there's...
It's amazing.
Well, I mean, there's one thing. One of my you know, my mentors, a guy named Neil Bloom. And Neil, you know, amazing guy. He you know, grew up really, you know, poor. Brilliant guy, built an empire really in real estate, and did so on the by sheer will. Mm-hmm. And he used to always comment on the idea of being short-term greedy or long-term greedy, right? And not to try to make greed into, like, I know greed has a negative connotation, but I think his philosophical bent was a little bit different, which is, you know, short-term greedy is saying that, hey, I want something right away.
Right.
Long-term greed is invest into the relationship, get to know the people, make it so that there is an inherent, you know, desire to work together and create real value over the long term. And I think that's really how I enjoy working. I like to be friends with the people I'm working with.
Right.
And that's a lot easier if you spend a lot of time getting to know them, investing in the relationship, understanding what makes them tick.
Right.
Not expecting to go into something and say, hey, you know, give me money.
Right.
Or give me a business partnership or do this or do that. That's a nice byproduct, but it shouldn't be the intention when you go into it.
Right. And to me, as I learn and get smarter, that is, short-term is fragile. Mm-hmm. Long-term is sturdy.
That's right. That's right.
Long-term is something you can count on.
Right.
Short-term is, might not pick up the phone
when
you're in a pinch. Long-term picks up the phone. Long-term bails you out of jail.
Yeah, that's right.
Short-term puts you on do not disturb.
Exactly. And look, that's, you know, we have become as a whole, and I'm guilty of it at times too, is we've become as a whole a culture of immediate gratification.
Right.
And that's fine to a certain extent.
I mean, we've been becoming a culture for a long time.
Yeah, no, it's kind of a, you know, an intentional creep forward in that direction. But I think that if anybody's honest with themselves and they think back to the part of their career or their part of their friendships or the part of their, you know, kind of travels, whatever it is, whatever makes them tick, whatever makes them happiest.
Right.
If they think through and try to identify what portions of each sides of those, you know, every part of their life is the most engaging, it tends to be the ones where it's with people that you've actually spent time where there's a comfortable rapport. Because, you know, you always make a mistake in anything, it's whether it's a business relationship or whatever. And if there's an understanding, it's a lot easier to work through it to get to the other side. So, you know, you're able to communicate where, you know, there's a whole idea that, you know, people like to shelter their stakeholders from bad news. I think over communication is good. Share good news fast, but share bad news faster, because then people start to trust you. They don't start to discount things that you're saying because they assume that you're trying to be intentionally vague about things. And that's a relationship. That's not an interaction. That's not a transaction, right? It's a relationship.
Right. Yeah, my mind is working in several directions now, because when you say relationship, this would also go for romantic relationships too. This is just relationships in general.
Yeah, I think every relationship has a very clear-cut path forward. Now, it's all predicated on a foundation of trust, respect, rapport. And sometimes, you know, it can be common interests, but a lot of times it's diversity of interest, right? Mm-hmm. You know, not everyone is good at everything. So sometimes you meet people that you click with and then you're like, hey, I want to learn what they're doing. I want to get into that and I want to figure that out. You know, one of my closest friends, you know, we used to be a former, you know, boss of mine, but you know, we as a group went on a ski trip and I never knew how to ski. And, and I was like, you know what, this kind of looks fun. Let me try it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm not a good skier, but I like it. I enjoy it. And it became something that I do periodically now. And it was something I was able to share with my daughter and bring her into it. And now she likes it. So it's, I think those are the kinds of things that, you know, it's experiential. And it's very much a interpersonal, but you're right. It's whether it's in the romantic sphere, the business sphere, just the friend sphere, right? Which I think friends tend to become the family you choose, right? Mm-hmm. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah. What I'm starting to build this model now where you said, when you look back, I'm wondering if that when we look back, the reason why we loved that trip, the reason why we loved that desk on the trading floor, the reason why we loved, you know, that time that we spent in Spain is because we had the most genuine human contact in those times.
Right.
Because I can tell you, I got smarter and I got richer during COVID, but I do not look back going, ah, give me more of that. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
I look back at, you know, being in the hostel in fucking Mexico going, that was so fun.
Right. Right.
You know, with a $30 or $20 a night room, you know, and a freaking, you know, a dirty Tecate in my hand. Like it was like, wow, that was so much fun.
Right.
Because in the evening, right, everyone gathers around in the common area. There's a little party. It's just like, oh man,
yeah,
that was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we all have those moments.
Yeah. No, I think that's the beauty of kind of human interaction, genuine human interaction, not the, you know, prescribed ones that come
networking out.
Networking events or social media apps that are, you know, forced to combine people that have a, you know, mutual shared interest in, you know, each other's aesthetic, you know, views, right?
Yeah.
So it's like,
that was the most complicated way to describe dating apps, by the way.
Yeah. It's just something that I feel
well, it's terrible. It's not optimizing for the right things.
Yeah. I lament that my daughter lives in a world that is the norm, not the exception, but it is what it is.
Here's the deal. All of this stuff, this is core to my argument that collaboration is the lifeblood of financial and personal progress and success.
Right.
So collaboration means meeting people, means having a great network. If you can learn how to collaborate better and more effectively, things just get better over time. And the unique experience of what I was doing with my the social media stuff and the skits, it seemed at first very distant. Like I was in my office filming these silly videos and I'm just disconnected. Mm-hmm. And now as we're coming full circle into the podcast, into writing the book and all this other great stuff, it's like, oh, now is the rewards phase where we get to meet, we get to interact, we get to play and we get to learn. And whew, now I'm the happiest, you know, dude you've ever met.
Right.
This is as good as it gets. And in terms of what I see now that I sit around and talk with smart people all day like yourself, it's like what I see now is the people that are truly successful have this embedded awareness that collaboration is central and that these relationships are central. Man, the guy, I can't give you the details. You could read between the lines, guys, if you go zoom back to some podcasts. But the guy that was on the show, super cool guy, super smart guy. And then you bring him into a room socially and he's a great, he knows everybody. He remembers every single person's name, their position, their background. Like, you know, this person raised exactly this amount and this person does this and they're a specialist in this. And they were just featured in the Wall Street Journal for doing this. Bro, amazing.
Yeah.
that's as much of a superpower as the PhD in ML. And
absolutely. Because it makes people feel important. It makes people feel engaged. And it makes people feel heard.
Yeah.
Right? It's not that you're trying to do it to flex on your eidetic memory. It's that you're showing that you're genuinely interested in that person.
Yeah.
And so you took it upon yourself and you made the effort to learn about them. And that's a pretty cool thing. It feels good to be... yeah. To be remembered and felt, you know, and understood and listened to.
Yeah. And it's not a tactic.
Exactly.
It's not a technique. It's not in some sleazy sales manual under your,
exactly.
your in your nightstand.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
It's fucking real.
It is. It is. And it's also includes in it that understanding that, look, you're going to get to know people. And if you start to understand them, then the hiccups that come along the way are easier to kind of move past, right? Like my co-founder, Pulkit Jaiswal, and I in two of my companies and in the fund, you know, my boss, Brad Chambers, you know, we go at it from time to time. Like, you know, we have our disagreements but I got, you know, I view them in every which way family. And so it's a lot easier to move past that and get to a place of mutual understanding in part because, you know, in spite of all the disagreements, I always feel heard. And I think they do as well. And that's an important part of communication, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, and like you're saying that your friend who you know, who is your guest and goes into these rooms and remembers everything. Well, think about how those people came away from that interaction feeling. They're like, oh, wow, this guy really, you know, he made an effort to get to know me. He made an effort to understand me. And
yeah.
And their whole perception about him is now cemented in this way.
Yeah.
And that's, you never, you know, that impression never goes away.
Right. And good luck trying to put a dollar amount on that. Cause no, it's
exactly,
it's infinite.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, every
absolutely.
Single person in the room said, this is such a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
He, and by the way, he can get on a plane and do this, take this show on the road. He's doing this in Dubai. He's doing this in Singapore.
Right.
The same deal.
Yeah.
The same level.
Yeah.
Of the same level of effectiveness.
And it's not a gimmick because it's genuine.
No, because as humans, all we're doing is using gimmick detection technology in our brains. We're like, are you full of shit? Are you full of shit? Are you full of shit? Even in romantic relationships, you're like, are you sure you did that? Or is that true? Yeah. May you tell me the truth here?
Right.
And we're pretty good at telling if someone's, you know, not being consistent.
Right, right.
And, you know, so because in the comment section, which I torture myself with from time to time. Some people say, yeah, that's just a tactic. That's just, that's what they'd like you to think.
Right.
You know, my channel is propaganda for wealthy people and telling them that they're nice. It's like, no, like, dude, no. It's, you would know if they were full of shit.
Right.
Some people just genuinely like the human experience.
Right.
And it translates to other cool stuff.
Right. Right. No, it's, look, I mean, and, I, you know, speaking as somebody who grew up with very little, great childhood, great, you know, great family life. I regret nothing. I think my dad was the most amazing man I've ever known and somebody I aspire to be even 10% of what he was. But, you know, it's better to have stuff than not have stuff. I can say that. It's more enjoyable, but it's
And you
never,
grew up with very little stuff.
Yeah. So
compared to,
but what I had was a very supportive family.
Mm-hmm.
I never was made to feel like I don't have, right? And I think that in and of itself is an asset. That in and of itself is wealth that you can't really put a price tag on. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, anytime you kind of go back and think about, okay, well, what if this, what if that, you kind of look back and say, well, you know, what's the worst it can be? It'll maybe go back to the way it was previously, but I was happy and we were all happy. And, you know, I think that.
Meaning as you continue to take risks and the numbers get bigger and the zeros keep going off.
You know, I'm ironically as an entrepreneur and as a fund manager, it's a bit odd, but I am a relatively risk averse person. Mm-hmm. I don't take a lot of risk necessarily. I think I, you know, am always of the view that you need to measure risk to the extent that you're comfortable being a fiduciary, not just for your investors, but your stakeholders, because everyone that works with you and for you has a life and has a family, and they need to put food on the table.
Right.
And it sucks.
Meaning so you blow up the fund, you don't just blow up the investor's money. You also, everyone doesn't have a job anymore.
That and you know, and their families need insurance and
right.
you know, and like, and especially in this environment today where like we are, you know, in a tough economic environment.
Yeah.
You know, there's no, you know, sugarcoating it. But I think it's increasingly important now to be more human.
Mm.
Because it's easy to be misunderstood because you're getting bombarded with so many comments and so much information, micro-publishing. People are putting their feelings out, you know, instantaneously mm-hmm. and then regretting it instantaneously, but it's already out there in the yeah. ether, right?
I'm in the business of that, by the way.
No, but it's, you know what the thing is that
I'm like, why did I say that on this goddamn podcast?
Right. But you know, it's that is what's creating, and that's part of why now the whole generative AI thing, right?
Yeah.
It's what's fascinating about it is the speed with which data specific to consumer sentiment or individual sentiment is being aggregated gives insights into how people think and operate more so than it was ever possible before.
Let's explain this. Yeah.
So
like, break it apart.
So to give you an idea, what I mean by that is that now, for example, one of the startups, NWO, is like I like to kind of say like the eye of Sauron, you know, it focuses on sentiment data and it okay. takes that to try to figure out what's going to happen on certain trends going forward. And it's aggregated, you know, petabytes of information circling around all social aspects. And because of the fact that information now is hyperlocal, it's hyper-specific to individual personalities, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, there's a gravitational force that the loudest voices tend to have.
Right.
And so it's becoming increasingly, the more data that gets aggregated, the more precise it's becoming to be able to anticipate how certain trends are going to evolve. So put another way, it's kind of like you can create almost like, and I know this isn't accurate. And so for geneticists out there, please don't, you know, don't
worry. That's a very small percentage of my audience.
No, but you know, I've seen.
They're like, dude, I don't want to follow this guy.
No, I've seen in comment section.
They're in the Huberman DMs right now.
No, but it's like kind of creating like a genetic sequencing of how trends emerge,
okay.
evolve, grow, and then die.
And mapping the topography of trends.
Exactly. So that is something
trends
that,
of everything.
Of everything. This is now the platform is used by people to look at and anticipate product development needs within, you know, L'Oreal, Estee Lauder, LVMH, okay. you know, Haleon, which is a spinoff from GSK, bunch of others, right? Mm-hmm. And what it's able to do now is it learns. So unlike in the past, people always looked at it's what called, you know, from a data perspective, they looked at what was called frequentist approach, which is linear regression, right? Now you have an
meaning ability. I spot when something's outside of the norm.
Well, you look at past data
yeah.
and use past data to predict future
right.
trends. Now what you have is you have an ability to create a modeling system that learns.
Mm-hmm.
It's probabilistic. So that's called a Bayesian approach. So what it does
normal
is-
normal curve distribution.
Right. So it looks at past patterns and looks at current deviations from that past mm-hmm. pattern, not as an outlier, but saying, okay, does that actually impact? Is that indicative of a fundamental change? And use that to reconstitute that trend line to figure out what's going to happen in the future. So that was exciting. And now we've kind of taken that. And sometimes you create cool tools, but it's important to do it for the right reasons. It's not always about money.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've started to use that with one of the Ukrainian ministries and in their Center for Strategic Communications to help mitigate some of the misinformation that's being generated within social media. And so the ministry is actually actively using that for purposes around identifying and countering misinformation. So that and we did that for free because it's just the right thing to do. It's
misinformation has a fingerprint.
it can have a fingerprint, but more importantly, it has a source, right? We, from a hyperlocal standpoint, you can find where certain ideas are originating and how it's then we are able to map how it's spreading. And so when you're able to do that, you're able to identify, okay, well, if this is how this information is coming out into the general public discourse, and this is how it's moving through society, you can then figure out how the propagandists are trying to get certain commentary out there.
I see. Almost like you throw a stone into the water and you see the ripples.
That's right.
And you could reverse engineer where the stone fell.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so that's something that we've been increasingly doing, and that's become now, I think, a more, you know, it's become an equally interesting perspective that we have. And so that then in turn, you know, kind of fed into what something I'd been working on since 1994, which is to try to figure out, now we have the computational power to be able to do that, right? Which is, and that's the other startup, that's Haystacks, which is to try to figure out how do you take all of this data, right? Everyone, you know, real estate is, the problem with real estate is, the good thing and the bad thing is it's very predictable. That's a good thing. The bad thing is it's very predictable, right? Right. It's, people don't use new techniques. It's kind of, you know, the state of the art 30 years ago is still the state of the art today.
I see.
And so, you know, how do you evolve? You know, people always talk about, you know, tech is revolutionary, and the thing is, real estate needs to be about evolution, not revolution, right? And
evolution in what way? In
incremental moves forward.
Yeah.
There's an enormous mistrust or distrust that people within the sector have on, you know, a young kid coming in and saying, "I know your business better than you do, and I can reconstitute your entire process." That's not going to fly. That's not going to go over very well. It has to come from inside, and it has to be something that's incremental, not completely kind of, it can't be a leap forward. It has to be a small step forward and sequentially keep doing those small steps.
What kind of things are we solving for? Are we building, structuring portfolios? Or what are we doing?
So I'll give you an, the founder of the fund that I work for, Buckingham, Brad Chambers, he's, you know, great guy, started this company from scratch when he was 20, built it up into a massive entity. But, you know, one of the things that he's always focused on, and then, you know, another friend of mine who invested into my startup as well, they both did, Jeff Dishner, who's with Starwood, they, you know, one of the comments that they were saying is that they've made certain investments over the years that were different from their traditional markets. And, you know, and Jeff, for example, was guest lecturing in a class I teach, and he commented on how he made an investment, or they made an investment in a market, and that had one of the best IRRs that they've ever had, and it wasn't a market they'd been in before. He's like, "Boy, I would have loved to have actually done 10 more deals in that market." So how do you do that? And so what we've been able to do is create a data lake and ingest enough real estate specific data, but then feed into it consumer and sentiment data that comes from all other sources, like whether it's TikTok or whether it's Twitter or what have you, and use that to say, okay, well, you're investing in these markets, and out of these 10 markets you're in, these three are doing the best. Well, if you like these three markets, I can map out why these markets have been performing well relative to your core strategy and thesis, and start to suggest markets that may be thousands of miles away, but it may not echo, but it certainly rhymes. Mm. And so it'll start to suggest and recommend places for you to start considering that you wouldn't have thought about otherwise.
Interesting.
And so that's kind of a cool thing. And the goal, you know, again, this is 30 years of my life, so it's something that I've been waiting for technology to catch up. But, you know, it was the person that I first talked about this with and kind of spent a lot of time was one of my professors, Amartya Sen. You know, if people want to look him up, brilliant guy. He won the Nobel Prize in economics in 97 or 96. But, you know, the idea was, okay, how do you take all of this data that we have, and that's just not easily accessible. Now it is. Now it's becoming more accessible. But how do you process it to help reduce kind of friction of transactions? How do you reduce that deadweight loss, so to speak, right? So that ultimately, especially in housing, if you're able to eliminate some of the frictional cost of investing,
right,
it's a win-win. You're able to pass those savings along
right
to people, you know, because we have a real housing crisis, right? The rents are, you know, have been skyrocketing, and housing is generally becoming more expensive, less accessible. At Buckingham, I think one of the things that I respect a lot about Brad Chambers is that his focus has always been, no matter what, he maintains an approach of keeping rents at below 25% of the income.
Okay.
And that's not easy to, in part, you do that by making sure that you don't increase rents just because you can.
Right.
And that's, you know, look, you don't get credit for that all the time. He doesn't certainly get credit for that, but it's something that he does because he's always viewed the, you know, the middle class and people that kind of, you know, not just white collar workers, but blue collar workers as well, as being the backbone of the country. And so that's cool. But one way to kind of improve that is to use data to your benefit to reduce the friction of doing deals so you can pass those savings along.
Right, right. The friction of doing deals, meaning human hours.
Human hours.
Burning time, research.
Transparency, lack of data, opacity of data.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, you know, even if you have all the information out there, the human element, understand or thinking through what that data means.
And thinking takes time.
And thinking takes time. And by the time you figure out what it means, the information has already moved.
Mm.
And so it doesn't mean what it meant anymore.
Right.
So you need processing power to be much more timely, to have a view instantaneously about what it means, right? And that's the value of, I think, everything, like whether it's AI, whether it's machine learning, all of these things have a real benefit. I mean, there are risks, sure. I think a lot of people are worried about AI, and rightly so. And we've all seen Terminator, and we've all, you know.
Yeah, all. But you're with the dude that thinks that this is our flight to ultimate human expression and freedom. So,
right.
I'm not sweating Schwarzenegger.
There you go.
I'll see him at the gym. That you know, that's the only time I'm seeing Arnold, okay? If I ever walk into Gold's Gym, which I still haven't done yet.
Gold's Gym's
a real thing.
Does it still exist?
Yeah. Don't make me Google this. It's definitely real.
I'm sure it's real.
They're down to a few locations, but it's definitely real.
Sure.
Let's go.
There you go.
Let's shoot from the Gold's Gym.
Yeah, let's get the
Really Rich Podcast.
The tank tops.
We're 100% getting the tank tops.
The tank tops. The what is it called?
They're called singlets.
Singlets, but they also what is it? Like I've always imagined wearing like the tie dye like
the
those,
pants.
Those yeah
the
those,
Zubas.
Well, I don't know what they're called, but they look like they looked like. You know, those MC Hammer pants.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Does your audience know who MC Hammer is, or are they too young to know that?
Hey, listen, let's pull up the curve. I think we've got plenty of people in that camp, at least a couple hundred thousand. So we're still good.
All right, there you go.
There's a few people laughing at that joke.
There you go.
Those outfits, the singlets and the tie-dye pants, that will be mandatory for the next time that we meet.
There you
and
go.
Shoot
there
this pot.
Absolutely.
So, I want to just in my own.
I'll be sure to grow a mullet.
Please do. Done. I've already got you. I've got you now. Allow me to think about haystacks in the simple way that I think about things. It's like you're building this constellation that a professional technician who's touched the market for fucking 20 years could do in seconds with technology.
Right.
Because what humans do is we take in disparate data that we don't even know we're taking in, mm-hmm. and we make decisions.
Right.
It's the trader that sees the pigeon fly a certain way before he walks onto the floor. It's the trader, well, that's a bad example. Well, actually, it's not a bad example. The pigeon might be flying away because it's about to rain.
Right.
And rain might affect the crop in Boise, Idaho. And he's a corn broker, cotton broker, whatever it is. These old timey stories, I mean, right. there's truth to them.
Yeah.
Because as a processing machine, the human brain is pretty darn good mm-hmm. at taking in all these data points. But it's not quite as good as supercomputers, unlimited data power, processing, just frictionless processing mm. at scale, more data points than you can see with your naked eye or human experience.
Right.
Meaning it's almost like, hey, I know the Bronx, like the back of my hand. And with a computer, you could say, I have never been to Memphis, but I know Memphis like the back of my hand.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great, great analog to it. That's a great analogy. I think that's exactly right, is that computational power lets you take a very limited exposure to something, but then become an expert on it with that limited exposure.
And then the future gets really interesting.
Yeah, yeah, no, it does. I do agree that there needs to be some ethical bounds to how to utilize it. I think, you know, it's less about whether we're going to be, you know, whether there's going to be a rise in the machines. That's not what concerns me. What concerns me is how that the use of some of those technologies can be abused by bad actors. Mm-hmm. And that's an entirely different
conversation.
And so that's really where my concerns lie. But I do think that, look, you can't unring a bell. The data's out there. People mm-hmm. are using the data for any number of things. Can you make it so that the people that are generating the data own a portion of it or are stakeholders? I would argue they are already yeah. because it's driving innovation that's very consumer and customer centric. Mm-hmm. It's creating, it's helping develop products that are much more in tune with what people will want or do want.
Right.
And it's also helping reduce some of the cost of reaching out to those consumers so that you don't have to essentially, you know, bake in that cost of marketing outreach into right. the underlying cost of the product, which, you know, I think can become, you know, can add to the expense of these things. So right.
there's a reason why the Kraft mac and cheese costs $2.75.
Right.
25 cents of that box of mac and cheese was used to make sure that you still remember Kraft mac and cheese when you think about mac and cheese.
Yeah. I still eat mac and cheese.
Me too. I've never forgotten about mac and cheese.
And cereal. I love cereal.
So look, man, I wish we could just, cause I love this topic.
Yeah.
What I hope is that you keep me up to date
sure.
on the way that you see mm-hmm. this evolution.
Yeah.
And what this access to data does to deal flow. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a student of this process.
Absolutely.
And it's a pleasure to have you
Thank
on
you.
With
Thank
me, man.
You same.
Because the magic of the room is maybe we would have never had this exact conversation
right.
if we were just sitting at a restaurant.
Right.
So for that, I'm thankful.
But I do love eating. So we're gonna
we're
do
still
lots
gonna
of
do that.
Yeah, yeah. So and in Miami too.
Facts.
One of my big regrets is you did invite me to your birthday in Vegas, and unfortunately, I was traveling and I was unable
to
go.
You're not supposed to tell anyone that.
I'm kidding. But
they'll find out eventually.
Yeah, there you go. But I think when I'm down in Miami next, for sure. One of my friends moved down there recently, and I think one of her friends, Eve, is going to be down there as well, who happens to be with one of our clients, but is also a good friend. So I'm sure, you know, we'll make sure to connect you guys as well.
Hey,
but that's
mi casa, su casa. And yeah. The power of collaboration, guys, that's how the pod ends.
Yeah.
And
you are going to meet you may meet a friend of yours today, by the way. A friend of mine who's in, ironically, in finance, much like, you know, you used to be.
Right.
And on the side, likes to do kind of stand-up comedy. Nicole is apparently a big fan and listener of your podcast.
Okay.
So that'll be interesting.
All right. So, you know, this episode's going to come out in probably about 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay.
But, you know, New York, you might see us out in Soho at large tonight.
There you go. All right. There you go.
Thanks for joining, man. Soho might see us out at large tonight.
All right.
Dude, thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate you.
It was great being here, man. Yeah. Thanks.